working with the theme, The American Mind and the Witness of the Gospel, and today with the topic, The Loss of Identity and the Search for a Gracious Humanity. Let me kind of bridge our way into that and then begin with prayer. We've been working with some themes in American thought, themes that emerge within our history, not always from our history, but within it, as motivating ideas, as ideas with power and persuasiveness with regard to the way we think and feel and act, and then trying to track how those intersect with the gospel in ways that are either mutually supportive or contradictory or conflicting. Today, then, we'll be working with identity questions. With that in mind, let's begin in prayer. We ask you, Lord, help us to know ourselves as we really are. Help us to be aware of that identity which is given by you to all humanity, and also of that identity which comes to us in Christ. Help us then as servants to share with others those things that make for meaningful identity, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Some of you who weren't here last week didn't hear me build a brief but I hope useful case for the thought that ideas have consequences. So now I'd like to build that again, just very briefly. There has been a tendency sometimes in the American experience to think that ideas were just aesthetic things that aesthetic people fooled around with while the rest of the Americans did what really needed to be done, that we were kind of a doing society. But in fact, ideas have had more consequences, have been more persuasive in the American experience than those critics would admit. Ideas, whatever their origins, have a way of having a life of their own. They have a way of changing, if they must, or adapting as they may, of submerging and seeming to die, and then reemerging like a cat with nine lives, sometimes looking different, but seldom just dying without a trace. Ideas have consequences. They result in something, both in the way people think and feel and in the way people act. With that in mind, we've been tracing certain ideas from their point of origin in the American experience to their present shape and power among us. What I'd like to do now is to go to a different form of the uses of intellectual history. In other words, instead of dealing with an individual idea or cluster and tracing it through, what I want now to deal with is the combined consequences of the ideas that have shaped us, have shaped our minds and our consequent behavior. I'd like to deal with the combined consequences for our day of the ideas that have dominated and have shaped us. In these remaining sessions, then, today we'll talk about identity and relationship, tomorrow about behavior and morality, and on Thursday about mission and ministry. The titles look a little more complicated than that, but that's really what it's about. Then Thursday noon we leave. So at that point I come to a disjuncture. Let me start just by talking about identity itself. Identity as a prerequisite for effective living, effective relating. There is a necessity for knowing who we are, for knowing what behaviors are appropriate, what roles are expected, even of knowing what feelings and needs are legitimate. To know whether and to whom and how to relate. Those are all pieces of what can be labeled identity. There is a sense in which we need some stable statement of who we are. I better personalize it. There is my need for a stable statement of who I am and who you are. That without those kinds of cues, I'm in trouble. I can't just kind of be in a place and just sort of let myself flow into everything that's going on around me. I have to have some sense of who I am and some sense of who you are. I could be very wrong about who I am or very wrong about who you are, but I can't operate in the absence of that sense of my identity and yours. None of this is automatic or even simple. It is not easy to develop one's identity. There may be some predisposition by way of biology. In other words, there may be some things about my identity that are given by the race I am, by the sex I am, by some things like that, biology may predispose in some modest ways, but not nearly as thoroughly as some of the new fundamentalists would like to argue, where they would suggest that biology is really normative, that you are told what to be and your only choice is to be that or not be that. Biology just does not dispose that thoroughly. There is also a sense in which the fact that I'm a spiritual being says something about my identity. But even though you grant that there are certain predispositions, certain kind of tendencies or pressures telling me who I am and telling me who you are, that doesn't really settle the matter at all. In fact, it barely introduces the matter. In stable societies, at times when societies feel stable and as though they are remaining the same, identities are presumed by those who are in the society. They are practiced by those who are in the society. They are taught to those who are coming into the society, whether by birth or by immigration, and they are caught. In fact, if Margaret Mead is right in some of the things that she did with those societies that had not yet been disturbed by outside influences, the fact is that most identity didn't have to be taught in the sense of the formal statement of fact. It was so thoroughly presumed and so thoroughly practiced that people simply caught it. And nearly everybody conformed, and the few who, for whatever reason, couldn't, were ostracized, killed or driven out or treated like those who did not belong. In stable societies, identities were presumed, practiced, taught, and caught, and therefore replicated. One was what one was taught to be, and that was almost synonymous with what one's parents had been taught to be and had been. The methods of communicating that kind of identity can vary greatly. It can be a preparation for initiation, and if you've ever had to plow your way through some of Margaret Mead's stuff, you know something about what that's like. When someone is prepared for initiation, there is that communicating of identity. This is what you are supposed to become. Or there can be rituals of remembering. When you look at the way the Hebrews celebrated the Passover, that was really an exercise in reinforcing an identity for those who already had it and teaching an identity to those who were still in the process of being shaped. Or it can simply be to replicate. You can simply point and say, that's what a man is, or that's what a worker is, or that's what a family is, and if you want to be one of us, that's what you must replicate. But when a society is unstable, when it is in the midst of drastic change, when a given set of identities has either been destroyed from the outside, pressures, social forces or political or military or whatever forces have simply destroyed the fabric of a society, when it's been destroyed from the outside, or there is some voice from within that declares that the old set of identities are not adequate. Whenever that happens, persons and their societies undergo at least confusion. And if it is severe enough, they undergo crisis. There is a sense then in which identity becomes one of the casualties when there is change, whether it's being forced from the outside or pressed from the inside. And I think one could argue that the American society is in the midst of an identity crisis in a way that is different enough from what's happening in crisis terms in other parts of the world so that we can properly talk about it as our crisis. I don't know when the phrase identity crisis was first thought up and used. I remember first encountering it in the early 50s, and at that time it was a phrase that sounded neurotic and weak-kneed. It sounded like something that was used by artists and authors and then later by the counterculture. I remember someone once describing it as a social disease for those who could afford it or had nothing better to do. An identity crisis was for people who just, you know, they wanted to kind of mess around with internal space because they either didn't have the guts that it took or whatever to grapple with all the big issues out there, to go on with the American dream and that sort of thing. If I pick symbols, I suppose every symbol has its problems, but I'll pick two of them anyway. Of the way the identity crisis thing first sounded, I would pick George Patton and John Wayne as people who poured contempt on those who had identity crises. Big Duke, it seems to me, whatever the storyline, there was always another kind of thing going, and it was that other kind of thing that became the enduring mystique of Big Duke. And that was that somehow he was adequate to everything that was coming along. What's the matter with the rest of you if you can't cope? There was always that kind of latency. And with Patton, of course, it's a different kind of thing. In its own right, the Patton story is a fascinating one. It became even more important to know that one of the residents of the White House used to watch that movie many times a year. Richard Nixon had a private copy of the Patton film and had it shown quite often, and would invite people in to see it with him. And then they would talk afterward about the kind of rugged individualism and the sense of purpose and destiny that came out of that. That's a fascinating kind of use of a particular symbol. If you want to pick a different kind of illustration, Joseph McCarthy, the Wisconsin senator, in his investigations into un-American activities, really was particularly angered by those who said that the traditional identity that was called American was somehow wanting. And he tended to investigate the spokesmen for un-American activities, the Arthur Millers and the Woody Guthries. These were the people that, when they raised questions about the adequacy of the identities in traditional America, McCarthy raised questions about their patriotism, and it was that kind of style that was going on. Well, that may have been true when, and I don't know, maybe the identity crisis language really grows out of the 20s, or maybe it grows out of Walt Whitman's poetry of the 1870s, you know. You can find it in retrospect all kinds of places. For me, I remember that it came of age in the 60s. And by now it has become clearer that identity crisis is not a neurosis induced by false prophets, but a crisis of the American dream. And I borrow that from a book title by J.D. Tipple, The Crisis of the American Dream. That what was happening, what is happening for us, is that our entire culture is going through a kind of a profound doubting about the givens of identity and purpose. That there is abroad in the land a pervasive doubt about whether we know for sure who we are and what kind of people we are supposed to be, both individually and corporately. Those who passed that way first, the star characters of Ernest Hemingway's novels or William Faulkner's novels or Tennessee Williams' plays or Arthur Miller's books and plays, they were the dramatic illustrations of people who had difficulties in life because identity was in question. They were the dramatic illustrations of what has now come to many more in much less sensational form. I said last week in passing, artists are people who get to the future first. And in that sense, they discovered ahead of the rest of us something that was happening in our society. Let me try to sketch it in terms of saying what we are not anymore and what we probably are becoming. If you hear me hedging, it's because I'm hedging. The traditional American identity was shaped by a set of ideas and a set of circumstances in this new world. It was not the matter of taking X number of thousands of immigrants and melting down their individual agendas and then coming out with a homogenized agenda. It was not that at all. Rather, what shaped the traditional American identity was the assertion of a few very dominant cues in and for the new world. Can I use the cue in the sense that a dramatist would talk about cues being given for somebody's lines, or cue as some kind of a pointer that says this is what comes next? That there were a few dominant cues that came to be held in common by most early Americans and then transmitted as an enduring heritage. For example, the ex-European male came very quickly to believe in his own right and to be told by others around him that he was to dominate. He should dominate his woman. He should dominate his environment. He even had permission to dominate his neighbor if by honest but shrewd dealing he came to be more prosperous than the neighbor. And that either demonstrated that he was an elect of God, if he was coming out of Puritan theology, or it just means that he had made the best use of the opportunities, if he was coming out of a more secular kind of mindset. But the cues that instructed him were cues that said, go and do, take over, dominate, control. He was told to be aggressive. He was told to be flexible. He was told to be honest but shrewd. And above all, he was told to succeed. The worst thing that could happen to him was to fail to succeed by the standards of the society that had decided what success was made up of. And she, the woman attached to him, was told to link her destiny to his. She was to civilize inner space while he civilized the external world. It's surprising how often that shows up in the literature of the time and in the kinds of instructions or reflections that people had about themselves and what they were to do. If I can just take an aside for a moment, as you by now know, I'm addicted to cartoons and funny papers. And I think one of the more useful funny paper columns right now is the Hager the Horrible one. Maybe I just like it because there's some Viking in my background. But Hager seems to me to be a very interesting person. One of the ones that I remember best is when Hager is sitting there eating. And he's throwing bones over his shoulder when he's done with them, and he's slurping his soup and all that kind of thing. And the mother and the daughter are talking to each other. And the daughter is saying how crude her father is, and the mother says, yes, and you should have seen him before I civilized him. That was the kind of mystique. A man, especially a self-made man in American society, did not have to be aesthetically acceptable. He was, after all, the model. The rest of them could adjust to him. But a woman had the obligation to civilize her children, and sometimes she had to civilize him a little bit for the sake of them. You know the Bess Truman story about, at least it's always told about her, about when Harry talked about hauling manure, and somebody said that she ought to teach him to say fertilizer, and she said it took me 20 years to teach him to say manure. That kind of sense of the civilizing process. All of them, both men and women, were told to feel right about who they were and what they were doing, and to feel superior about themselves and their nation over against other people in other parts of the world. First over against those in Europe, but later over against people of other races and other cultures. There was a kind of a superiority mystique that came to be one of the cues for identity. And they were told, that whole business by which a culture communicates its values, they were told to value independence and self-direction above the needs of community, and to honor the needs of community only when there was, as Roosevelt put it, some enlightened self-interest in that whole thing. Now, whatever their shortcomings, those kinds of cues to and the identity that they evoked were at least very certain. And certainty, when you come to the matter of identity, is something to be coveted. It is the most comfortable to be certain about your identity, even if what you are is not very rewarding. I just want to dabble for a little bit in the whole business of the Exodus and the wandering in the wilderness. It seems to me that one of the ways to study identity at a little bit of distance is to look at what happened when a slave people were able to escape their slavery in terms of the externals, but who had a terrible time getting rid of their internal sense of slavery, and who, as Moses put it more than once, lusted after the flesh pots of Egypt and wondered why on earth they had come out into this barren place in the wilderness. If you press the image a little bit, it may well be that the generation that had grown to adulthood in Egypt could not make the whole identity transition from slave to dominators of the promised land. And so they had to die halfway between and only those who were children in Egypt or who were born in the wilderness could make the rest of the adaptation that carried them into the promised land. Now, if I want to go even further afield and say an even riskier thing, it may well be that every liberation movement, whether it's women's liberation or black liberation or whichever other one you want to take, it may well be that that is always a two-generation process. It may well be that those who break with the enslaving past can only get as far as saying what they are not and what they want to be. But it may well be that it's only the next generation after that, since it did not know slavery, since it did not know Egypt, could then know the new land and enter it, and even then not feel quite comfortable and at home. You may want to pick that up later on in discussion. Well, what happens then is that all of this stuff is in question now, or at least a great deal of it. The traditional identities have been called into question. Our worldview has been challenged and sometimes found wanting. Our economy and our lifestyle are seen as oppressive and selfish by others, not only in our own land, but around the world. Our very sexual roles are brought into question, because one of the dominant cues that happens in a traditional kind of identity giving is that you're told what it means to be a man or a woman, and you're also told what it means to relate to other men and what it means to relate to people of the opposite sex. That whole business is drawn into question, so much so that certainty has vanished, and we are rendered less powerful and less purposeful. Alfred North Whitehead, I consider him philosopher, writing at a time when things seemed much less in crisis than right now, although in fact the book was Adventures with Ideas was published just about, 4 months before the Great Depression came, the stock market crash. But Whitehead uses the statement, the major advances in a civilization are processes that all but wreck the societies in which they occur. Now, the optimism shows up in the word advances, the major advances in civilization. I would not care to use it that way. I would rather change that word and simply say the major changes in a civilization are processes that all but wreck the societies in which they occur. And what we are experiencing is major changes, and the wreckage is all around us. For what it's worth, I guess I'll just preview tomorrow by saying I think it will get worse before it gets better. Those who hope we've bottomed out and that things are coming back together, I think, are harboring a forlorn hope. One of the first identities of the major change that is underway now is the old identity. One of the first casualties is the old identity. Where does an identity crisis show most? I want to just pick a few illustrations. It shows in the depressions of the very sensitive, people who I would contend are not weak at all, but are simply what somebody has called the human seismographs, who feel what's going on before other people feel it. Dick Vangerud, a pastor of the American Lutheran Church, now on the staff at Luther Seminary, spent 2 years at the Menninger Institute in Kansas and in its religion and health program. As his major project during that, he attempted to isolate common factors that predisposed Great Plains people to depression of the type that was severe enough to bring them to Menninger's for treatment. And in the process, you know, you discover a lot of things that are common to depression, but he did discover some special things, and the special things are very illustrative. Discovered that by and large, these were very sensitive people, not weak, but very sensitive people. And what had happened was that for them, the American dream of progress through change had turned into the nightmare of loss through change. That what was happening for them was that they had grown up believing this kind of business about the progress of the American dream. But when they looked around them at the fruits of change, what they saw was that change meant that old neighboring farms had been bulldozed under and the neighbors had long since gone. Old schools had been closed and consolidated, so they couldn't even point back and say, that's the school I went to. Little communities, the little tiny crossroads communities, had been rendered economically useless by good highways and good automobiles. So their little communities were disappearing. And you can go on and just kind of multiply that. They had learned to farm with big machinery. Great change, marvelous improvement. That meant their kids didn't stay on the land. So they lost their children, you know. You just go on and on with that. And what they had finally come to in terms of depression was the sense that the major change in the society was wrecking their lives. It was robbing them of meaning. By the way, another illustration of a different kind. Time magazine, in an essay of, I would judge, 10, 12 years ago now, did a biographical analysis of the top television news anchor persons. Do any of you remember that essay? It was, at that time, Huntley, Brinkley, Reasoner, Cronkite, Eric Severide. Oh, I can't remember all 10 now. What they did was to start the essay by saying, would it be interesting to know what were the common elements of background of these, and they were all men at that time, of, I guess they still are, aren't they, these men who managed to rise to the top in what one would consider to be a very sophisticated business and certainly part of the Eastern Seaboard establishment. And they postulated in advance that one would expect that these were urban-born, on the Eastern Seaboard most likely, or maybe on the West Coast, since there's an element of entertainment in television news, that almost certainly they would have gone to, been born into fairly good circumstances, have had some of the advantages of life, put that in quotes, would have gone to the better schools, and so forth. Then they do their biographical survey of the 10, and they drop in a caveat that says, but of course, 10 never makes a good survey sociologically. But, and then the rest of it's the filling in of the but. But isn't it interesting? Most of them, it turns out, were born in the Midwest or the agricultural West. Most of them were either born on the farm or in tiny little communities. Most of them went to the kinds of grade schools and high schools we have since closed because we considered them inadequate. Most of them either didn't go to college or went to the kind of school you never heard of, so you got to say, where on earth is that? And yet here they are at the top in a very sophisticated business. And then Time asks itself the rhetorical question, how do you account for that? And Time's answer was, it is probable that these were men who, as children, were born into societies where the identity cues were still online and unquestioned. They were born into communities where you knew what was expected of you and what was expected of others. You did not have to cope with a broken family or with a liberation theme or with avant-garde educational ideas. You know, you just were in the midst of a very stable environment, so you could develop a sense of who you were before you had to cope with all that other stuff. And by the time all that other stuff came along, you operated out of a stable internal sense of who you were. Not a fixed one. You could adapt. And you would point to somebody like Walter Cronkite and say, certainly he was an adaptable human being and developed the sophistication he needed, but he developed it out of a stable sense of identity. And Time said, do you suppose that part of the crisis of our time, this would be 1970 or thereabouts, is that more and more Americans do not have that reservoir of a given identity? They are having to grapple with questions about who they are before they have become someone. They can't start with a set of givens. There is a homelessness about us. To take Thomas Wolfe's famous phrase, you can't go home again. Home isn't there. Or to take Sinclair Lewis in terms of Main Street, that whole business that he was contemptuous of and could not tolerate living the way he grew up because he was already in the process of leaving. But neither could he ever feel right about where he was, and so he's caught between. You see it in the exploration of sexual identity. There is a tendency to immediately moralize about the sexual behavior of people in our day. It would be helpful if we didn't moralize so quickly. It would be helpful if we recognized that it is no longer clear in the carrying community what one's own sexual identity and expression is supposed to be, or how it is that you relate to other people sexually, and that is just bound to raise, not just immoral behavior, but that's bound to raise varieties of behavior exploration, and what's even worse, a kind of a constant hunting without closure. It shows up in patterns of aggression that alternate with patterns of dependency, and both of those describe things that are going on in our time. It results in a preoccupation with how we feel. Now, it's not bad that we are dealing something with how we feel. That's a good piece of identity development. Whoever coined the phrase that the ancient Greeks said, "I think, therefore I am," and then the early Americans said, "I do, therefore I am," and now the contemporary says, "I feel, therefore I am," that has more usefulness as a kind of a way of exploring options than is first apparent. But if you get kind of stalled in the matter of exploring feelings, if exploring them never leads to understanding and closure, then that's a problem. A cartoon that I carry with me in my briefcase. I don't carry very many, just two of them. You heard one last night. The other one is a Beetle Bailey cartoon. He's one of my favorites. Anyway, Beetle is on guard duty. He's got his rifle at ready. And in a loud voice, he says, "Halt, who goes there?" And from off in the bushes, you hear the voice of Plato, the resident intellectual at Camp Swampy, saying, "Who indeed am I? How often have I asked myself that very question? Is it possible to be objective or analytical? Or is the shock of self-discovery too painful for my fragile ego to accept? As Aristotle said, know thyself. Easy, you say. But oh, what a tangled web we weave to hide from that knowledge. And so, in summation, I know no more nor less than that I am here now in this period of time with all my strengths and weaknesses, a live, breathing participant in the game of life." The next caption, he comes into view, and he kind of waves and says, "Therefore, it is simply I, Plato, who stands before you." And he goes whistling on past, and Beetle scowls and says to himself, "Now I know why they don't issue us live ammunition out here." I think that catches some of the identity problem in a very useful kind of way. What new identity will emerge? Well, I'm only going to hint at things because I'm still in the business of trying to figure that out myself too. The moral majority and their political allies have one agenda. It is clear that what they want by way of identity is a recovery of rugged individualism, a recovery then of opportunities and of the aggressive permission to take advantage of opportunities to prosper. They want a reassertion of old family roles, which means the subordination of women to men and the dominance of a family by the male head of the family. They want a reassertion of national power and manifest destiny, which means they want us to recover a sense that we may not be totally right, but we're more right than the average bear. And they want a sense of local responsibility for social welfare, not a total lack of concern for others, but a localizing and a personalizing of that concern. Those of us who are liberals, and I label myself that way, are going through a time of agony, trying to edge toward the middle of an already narrow spectrum of options, but not at all clear yet about how to reassert that identity that we had hoped was going to be coming together. Provided Holocaust does not first destroy all life, it is likely that the necessities of now and the future will promote a quite different sense of identity for Americans. It will be, for example, and I just cite four pieces, it will be, for example, an identity which insists upon equality of the sexes and therefore will require that those who are married to each other will have to invest far more of their energies in the maintenance of a relationship than was required when people were forced to stay together no matter how they felt about each other. The equality of the sexes will be a piece of identity that will be more difficult, but also potentially more rewarding. Talk a bit about uniqueness. The new identity is likely to say that uniqueness is still a good thing, provided it is used as a giftedness, as a sense of contribution to common good. But we are less and less likely to honor those who use uniqueness as a way of distancing. We are going to see them as iconoclasts, as people who simply are too selfish for the rest of us to deal with. The trouble, of course, will be that there'll be so much of that in each of us that it's going to be an internal war, not a war between. In fact, what we will do is that our new sense of identity will be much more frankly interdependent. We will be much less likely to try to say, I don't need you and you shouldn't need me. Interdependence, by whatever language we finally use to describe it, will be a piece of our identity. It has been, I say this carefully, it has been salutary for us to have the OPEC nations squeeze the nozzle on us, because it reminded us that self-sufficiency is no longer a legitimate way of life, that in fact we never were self-sufficient, we were just always on the using and exploiting end, and now we're going to find that sometimes we are the exploited ones, and that will cement our solidarity with the needs of the rest of the world. We will find ourselves having to choose between an identity that is nationalistic in flavor, that says, I am an American, therefore I am who I am, or world citizenship, which says, I am a part of the whole created order, therefore I am who I am. And I hope you'll add to that list. Now, it's my goal to have more discussion today, so I'm going to close this off more quickly. But I do want to say a word about the search for a gracious humanity. I borrowed the title from George Forel, and the framework he uses is worth sharing with you. Forel said, in the 16th century, in both the Reformation and the more religious aspects of the Renaissance, the real question was, how can I find a gracious God? By contrast, he says, the real question in the 20th century is, how can I find a gracious fellow human? The idea of the search for gracious humanity just litters the pages of prophetic literature. But maybe you see it in some other places too. A favorite for me is the movie and the television series MASH. I think MASH is one of the most creative and helpful things on the tube right now, because you do have people who are trying to humanize and relate in the midst of inhuman circumstances. And when Alan Alda commutes between being the forever cynical joker and then in the operating room, the passionate surgeon who's trying to save a life, you catch the flavor. I think you catch it better than in Bertolt Brecht's stuff, which seems to me too often to simply write off all hope, or more than you do in Catch 22, which has the tendency to say, there's no sense trying, so let the rest of the world go by. MASH keeps trying. Alan Alda keeps grappling with humanity and relationship. But he still has to do triage, and he still has to deal with the inhumaneness of everything around him. Reinhold Niebuhr, 30 years earlier than that, said, civilization as we know it is nothing but a thin facade over barbarism. And our identity is going to have to come more in contact with that latent barbarism, so that we understand more how terribly important it is that we cement every connection with the rest of humanity as a way of repressing the barbarism that is harbored in all of us. When people were sure of themselves and of their proper goals and means, they were less dependent on relationship. But the uncertainty about self makes relationship with others both more essential and more difficult to achieve. One of the movies that has haunted me is that The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. I've forgotten the name of the... Alan Arkin, wasn't it? In The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, a devastating movie, one that I have to be in the right mood to watch. But that The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, that desperate need for people and the difficulty of building relationships. Finally, then, intersections with the gospel. We are a people who, if we dare, can work out a certain, no, not even work out, can accept a certain and given identity, because we are the people of God by creation. And we are also made specially the people of God by redemption. And we are a people who walk through life with the promise of a parousia, of a coming of back of wholeness, of the completion, the good completion of all things. But I think we will have to resist an identity that only works for those who are born again. You know, one of the diabolical things about the born again stuff is that it is as clear about who it leaves out and why as it is about who it includes and why. And in that sense, the born-again business is really terribly individualistic and terribly risky as a point of identity. It is better to see ourselves as the body of Christ in and for the world. I want to pick that up much more on Thursday, but I just signal it here. The body of Christ in and for the world is a better sense of what's special about us, and then we ought to evoke a common identity of solidarity with all the created order. It will be tragic if people have to turn their backs on organized religion and turn their backs on organized nationalism in order to achieve world community. But that may be what has to happen. I cringe every time they tell me that Muslims and Christians are fighting in Lebanon and that Catholics and Protestants are fighting in Northern Ireland. I cringe partly because there is so much more at stake, and it is a disservice to organized religion to suggest that these are primarily religious wars. But on the other hand, I cringe because there's unfortunately way too much truth in the fact that in the name of organized religion, people are doing barbarous things to each other. We're going to have to be those who, in the name of religion, are able to reach out in solidarity with the whole created order and to prize the common good. Our identity is going to have to be a common identity, using individualism to contribute, but not to distance. Your turn. It's too quiet. That's a different kind of history while you're trying to figure out how to respond. Maybe it's not history at all. Maybe what it says is what one set of ideas did and what new sets of circumstances are doing now. Let's see if you can open it up. Please.
You said a good deal there about the moral majority, maybe not as a specific movement, but in general, is moving toward. I think you also implied that out of that is going to hopefully come something much more promising. May also be something much more devastating.
Yes. Oh, boy, is there a lot at stake right now. That's right. Now, do you want me to just comment or do you want to ask questions?
Yeah.
Comment. By the way, I hate to think that Spiro Agnew was in any sense a prophet, but when he used in the late 60s the phrase the silent majority, he really was talking about the same people who are now the moral majority. And it is clear that moral majority is the same mentality, I want to say almost the same crowd, who were the prohibitionists of roughly 1890 to 1933, that the agenda really is to say that there was a good and original and pure, or relatively pure and innocent, America, and that outside forces, conspiratorial forces, or at least of poorer quality, that came and have spoiled that. That there were urban influences with their anonymity and their freedom for whatever kind of behavior goes. There were Catholics who brought with them a kind of a slavish feeling for an outside sense of authority that was different than ours. There's a lot of anti-Catholicism yet in moral majority. It's very much there. There's a good deal of anti-Semitism in moral majority. And the increase in the desecration of Jewish cemeteries, of synagogues, of the pressure on Jewish people to defend their right to retain their own identity, that's a kind of a frightening thing that's going on. Resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan, which has always had a kind of religious flavor to it. You know that it was not uncommon for Southern clergy, either by choice to be in the Klan or by the pressure of their constituency. If you want to see that clergy person, by the way, in worst caricature, take a look at the clergyman in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof in Tennessee Williams' play. Far worse than Father Mulcahy on MASH. Mulcahy is just ineffectual, but the clergyman in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is willing to lick any part of the anatomy that he's told to in order to get along. And it's just a terrible picture. Or if you want to get hold of a different kind of sense of clergy and the whole question of when to accommodate, take a look at the lay preacher in Grapes of Wrath, who preached in Oklahoma and preaches along the way But after he's involved in an altercation in which a man is killed in a work camp in California, then he says, I'm not fit to preach anymore. You get some very strange images going there. Moral majority is trying to reassert an old and stable and traditional understanding. And in that sense, were they to succeed, I think we would see another rather vicious round of forcing people to conform or forcing them out. I wanted to get into Brave New World and didn't get a chance to review this, so I'm pulling this from memory and it may be flawed, but isn't it in Brave New World that there is a reservation for the savages who don't fit? Anybody help me at this point?
Yeah, that's
right. Okay, and I remember that one of the savages breaks out of the reservation and comes to the hospice, although they don't call it that, because there it's not people who are dying naturally, it's people who are dying quickly because the youth maintaining drugs have been withdrawn from them by administrative decision. And the savage, they call him a savage, the savage can't tolerate the fact that they have decided that his mother is going to die. Now, you know, that whole twisting around of saying that whatever the majority, whatever the society has decided is right, and it's in that same thing that you have the kind of juxtaposition. You know, truth is falsehood, war is peace. What was the third one? They had three slogans in there. I can't remember the third one. Some more.
Regarding your statement that you see some anti-Semitism in the moral majority, first of all, a reaction and then a question. I have the impression that, from little I know of, and I haven't had time to study this really, that the term moral majority is generally used to refer to quite a broad spectrum,
yes,
of thought and action in our time, and that a number of these people within that broad spectrum may differ quite a bit. Some,
yes,
of them are very rigid, some are have no capacity for subtlety or ambiguity, and others are quite sophisticated.
Yes.
They disagree with one another in some quite important ways. Another thing, to be more specific, is that I have the impression that there's a great deal of support of the state of Israel. In fact, I would have heard somewhere recently that Begin had communicated with Jerry Falwell rather directly, and that the so-called evangelical right, which in some,
yes,
sense is overlaps the moral majority,
yep,
is quite consistently supportive of the state of Israel's right to exist, and so on. So,
yep,
I don't quite know how that all fits together.
One of the things that moral majority does in terms of recovering the original or traditional mindset is not allowing shades of gray. Things are either right or they're wrong, but you can't kind of lay it out on the Tevye scale of on the one hand, on the other hand. And in their terms, it's not so much a pro-Jewish attitude, because you got to look at what they're saying to Jews in this country, as much as it is an anti-communist sort of thing, and the belief that Israel is the best bulwark against communism in the Far East, and similarly, you see, they're very pro-Saudi Arabia. And in that sense, what we're looking at is a range of economic interests. It's the same group that wants us to reaffirm our ties with Taiwan at the expense of détente with communist China. I think that's more anti-communist, east-west return of the Cold War stuff than it is pro-Jewishness per se.
I must say, I don't have that impression from the little that I've heard.
Well,
I've had the impression that they're, you know, motivated by the fact that they still think of the people of Israel as the chosen people of the Old Testament era, and they are obliged from a Christian perspective to respect that and support them.
Oh, I think that's probably there. I think they are probably more benevolent toward the state of Israel than they are toward Jews in this country. The Klan is grossly anti-Semitic.
You're not identifying the moral majority with the group of the Klan.
I would say that the impulse that led to the resurgence of the one is also leading to the resurgence of the other. The same reassertion of dominant white middle class values is underneath both of them.
Matthew Fox talks in his book on compassion about that. What he sees one of the major enemies of compassion in this society is the group of people who have set security up as a false idol. And it seems like in both the case of the, now I don't personally compare the Ku Klux Klan to the Mormon majority, but they both come at life with the idea that security is one of our paramount objectives or things to go after, and they go after security to the point where it seems like Farwell is willing to, you know, say anything in support of Israel because it gives us some security from communists in that part of the world. And it seems like anything else that they want is made to give, you know, adult males a real big sense of security.
Yeah. I just want to say again, it's not that they are, I'm not suggesting that the moral majority supports the Klan, not that at all. I'm suggesting that the same set of impulses, and that's sort of what you said, same set of impulses are pushing in both ways.
I'd be interested if you could say anything good about moral majority.
Well, tomorrow, when we come at the question about what's immoral and what's just plain confusion, then it seems to me that we will have to look at the question about whether in the name of identity crisis and change and loss of motivation, whether we have in fact licensed the moment and said anything goes because after all we're lost. And in that sense, moral majority may at least be reasserting that not everything is relative. It would seem to me that that's kind of there. And I will try to pick some of that up more tomorrow.
How long do you anticipate it to take for America to establish a new identity? And do you think that the Christians will have a leading role in the establishment of a new identity?
How long will it take? It seems to me that it's a generation that we're looking at. A very creative generation. It'll be a time of great creativity. I think things will get worse before they get better. And the worse will show in economic terms. And then the spin-off will come in terms of violence or despair or social chaos. Will Christians have a part in the new order? Will we contribute to the new order? I think so. I think so in the sense that this is a society that builds institutions and then decides which institutions to trust and which ones not to. And while there has been a general erosion of trust in institutions, churches, organized churches, still rate higher in the Gallup poll does that every year, I think. They test the trust in institutions. The church ranks higher now in relation to others than we have in a long time. And so there is at least the opportunity to contribute if we know what it is we have to contribute, if we know which value system to share or which cues to identity.
Are you going to get back to that later in this series?
No, go ahead and...
Well, I'm just raising the question. We know our identity as the people of God in Jesus Christ, okay? What do we communicate to the world around us that's going to be useful and uplifting and progressive and so forth? How would we develop that sense of identity that we have in a way that will be useful to other people and that they'll catch and follow?
Yeah. One of them, and it's a key and crucial one, is to temper nationalism in such a way that nationalism is not the occasion for a sense of superiority, but rather the sense of a corporate way to contribute to the common good of the whole world. You know, a major contribution for us will be that matter of trying to help people develop, trying to help ourselves and those around us develop a commonality with the whole of creation and not just with those who have the same national identification as we have.
This is a terrible thing to share, but Jerry Falwell on Sunday morning had a guy on, had the Southern Baptist Convention, a guy who was a preacher in Texas, And one of the things, statements this guy made was that God in his infinite wisdom had given us the 6% of the world population, America, first crack at the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
As we can be keepers of that. And to me, that was the kind of thought that we really don't need right now, you know. And that, you know, it's just, my heart said, oh no, when I heard this guy saying this on national TV, but that kind of thought is the thing that really has gotten us in trouble and will keep getting us in trouble in the world. Seems like we're too, I don't know where I'm going with that, but just popped into my mind.
Yeah, a similar kind of thing. Who was the Southern Baptist leader who made that injudicious crack about how God doesn't listen to the prayers of Jews, and then had to back off when all the
Criswell?
Yeah, I think it was Criswell.
This was the same one who said the bomb given to us by God.
Yeah, that's that's heartland of moral majority stuff, and it does like simple, clear, right and wrong sorts of things. And it does have to declare a lot of things right that we ought to be more temperate about and less certain about. Time for a couple more. Yes?
You mentioned that we have to give up our nationalism more. And what is your solution for the problem? How are we going to operate as the world, as one, with two tremendously opposite,
yeah,
such as the Soviet Union and the United States, who are just 100% off being.
I probably chicken out of a radical solution at this point, and that just says something about me. I have not been able to convince myself that the world could be convinced to forego its nationalisms. I tend to think that nationalism is unavoidable, although historically you can argue that nationalism is a product of 15th and 16th centuries, that nationalism has not always been a mindset. But ethnicity's always been a mindset, so you've got another piece of it there. I tend to think that what we have to do is to temper our nationalism so that it is not a statement of superiority, but rather a statement of organization for the sake of service. Nationalism, it's what you do with nationalism. But I realize that that's an instinctively conservative response. And that just says something about where I am. I don't think the world citizen thing is possible soon enough, thoroughly enough, to become the way to deal with passions war potential. That instead people have to, that the patriotism has to become, that we have to be patriotic by challenging the superiority aspects of nationalism, but not challenging the cohesion itself. It's the uses. Somebody else want to respond, because that's a crucial kind of question.
Well, it seems like we're just butting heads, and if one gives in, the other takes over, and that's...
Yeah.
It's just an awful problem.
In a real polar view of the world, it seems that way. I think the world view is becoming less and less polar as OPEC and other major businesses and other countries are getting a bigger piece of the power pie in this world. It seems like at least my generation is starting to look less and less at a polar world and might be able to get over that.
You trigger a kind of an extraneous thought. Somebody reminded us that even the decision that we are the first world and that another chunk is the third world has a sense of superiority in it. You know, who are we to decide that as different as one piece of the so-called third world is from another, that can all be lumped? You know, that's all one kind. We'll have to take our place as one people among the peoples. Well, tomorrow we'll come at that the behavior question, immoral or just plain lost. What behavior between the times?